Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona Kay, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And my hope is that the information shared in this podcast will help you understand the strengths, differences, and challenges in your neurodiverse relationship as you move forward in life. Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. Welcome back to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. And I'm really happy to be back here talking with my guest co-host, Greg Fuqua. And this is the last episode that we are doing together, not the last episode of this season, but the last episode we're going to be talking with each other. And we're going to be talking about a few topics that I think are really, really important and may look very different in your neurodiverse relationship. And we're going to talk about repairing kind of major ruptures that may occur in your relationship. We're also going to talk a little bit about rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which all neurodivergent folks can experience very intensely. And we're going to talk a little bit about boundaries and a growth mindset. And we're going to talk a little bit about employment and how in some neurodiverse couples, there may be some challenges with maintaining employment. And we'll see where the conversation goes as usual. Greg, we always have great conversations. So welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Yeah, looking forward to another great talk with you.
Yeah. This one is, I think, really important. They're all really important. But I think this is something that neurodiverse couples experience a lot. Mm-hmm. And we actually had somebody send us an email asking us to talk about repairing major ruptures. And especially when one partner struggles to face their failures. And I've been reading one of the Gottman's books, Julie and John Gottman. It just came out, and I really couldn't recommend it more highly. It's called Fight Right. And yeah, it just came out, I want to say, in the last few months. And they talk about something, Greg, that I think is really important for us to all understand. And then, and that is when we are engaged in the same conflict over and over and over again, we have to really think about whether that is a perpetual problem. And the Gottmans say that 69% of the problems we experience or the conflicts we have are perpetual problems. Mm-hmm. And only 31% are solvable problems. So that's the first thing I think we need to think about. And I wonder sometimes if for neurodiverse couples, the numbers as far as perpetual problems are even higher than 69%, because we have different neurology, we have different needs and desires and dreams and whatever, but we may not even know what our needs are or our preferences, and it may take a while to realize that once we understand our neurotype. And so the conflict is around not really understanding ourselves and also not understanding our partners. Any thoughts on that before I move on to some other things that I think are important from the Gottmans?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of great points in there. So number one, you know, I think a lot of the couples I work with too, they involve the same type of problems and they revolve around these themes. If we never, right, get at those bigger themes, maybe those are traumas or value-oriented things that come out of our past, they do repeat and they do become frustrating. I think that, right, there might be assumption that we should be able to kind of work through this, but we don't really dig into it very far. And I think for a lot of people in general, but I think for autistics, two, there's a degree of self-blindness that can be there, which is I'm just myself, you know, and mm-hmm. I don't get why this is happening. And there's a level of comfort in also not digging in too deep, just being who you are. You know, I get a lot of young adults and teenagers that tell me that being autistic is just being myself. And so there hasn't been a lot of reflection to understand what are my cognitive styles, what are my triggers, what are my values, how all those things overlap and might interplay with somebody. If those things aren't dealt with, you're going to run into conflict in relationship for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. And sometimes it's really hard to go down that path of increasing your self-awareness, especially when you don't know how to regulate your nervous system. So, depending on what your kind of attachment style is, are you anxious? Are you avoidant? Are you secure? And, I don't think there are a lot of people out there that are secure 100% of the time. So I think we go between all the different attachment styles. And so if you're avoidant, you're going to run from any conflict. And oftentimes running can look like shutting down in a neurodiverse relationship, or it can look like screaming and melting down. And instead of taking time to really get to know what each other's needs and preferences and dreams are, we may get into the same type of argument and conflict and judging each other, and it can become very toxic, very, very toxic, very quickly, right?
And some of the things you're touching on are also so these cognitive styles and some of these traits that we see with like emotional intensity, right? Or alexithymia. If I've got that, do I really want to go to the hard stuff? Right? Do I really want to dig into that? And then, as you mentioned at the beginning, I may also have a lot of sensitivity around rejection, around my self-worth, And again, trying to dig into what are the things that I need to look at, what are the things that have gone wrong, can be a tough place to go. So I think there does need to be a lot of empathy, a lot of understanding, a lot of sort of supportive approach to this. And I thank God for my wife in terms of doing that myself, and in particularly on the employment struggles that I faced.
Well, I absolutely want to talk about the employment struggles because that was a big one in my relationship. But I want to give the listeners, I highly recommend the Fight Right book, but I want to give them some suggestions from the Gottmans that I think are really, really important. First of all, they use the term gridlock for those fights that you continuously are getting into, and there doesn't seem to be any resolution. You become, you hurt each other unintentionally or intentionally. There's toxicity, and it just keeps getting worse and worse. And literally, every time you have these conflicts, you are dysregulated. You don't feel good about yourself. You don't feel good about your partner. And if you kind of bring that RSD, the rejection sensitivity dysphoria, into it, which all neurodivergents can have, and I think people in general can have, but it's at different levels. I took everything personally in my marriage. And so, I would cry, I would scream, I would get very emotional whenever I thought I was being attacked or ridiculed or judged. And I didn't know how to look at that through a different lens. So when we get into those gridlocked conflicts that feel really, really, really horrible, there are usually needs and desires underneath that, or some trauma, or some dreams that we have that we're not communicating to each other. So there are six questions from the Fight Right book that I'm going to share, Greg, with the listeners. And I think they're helpful to think about answering individually, and that's what the Gottmans talk about, that you each take turns. So you ask these six questions of your partner, and you don't speak, besides asking the questions, you don't add anything to your partner's response. You let them share and you give them space to share, right? And I know in our communication workshop, Greg, you provided one of the exercises, which is the mic exercise. And I think this is great for neurodiverse couples, literally holding on to a pen or something that looks like a mic while each person is talking, so that you know it's not your turn to talk until you get the mic, right? Yeah. So here's the six questions. So the first one is, what do you believe about this issue that you're fighting about? Do you have some values, ethics, or beliefs that relate to your position on this issue? And we can talk about each question. Do you have any thoughts about that one, or do you want me to go on?
No, that's a great one, because I think you do have to get at what is it going on. You had mentioned earlier, like sometimes there's like financial differences, like how do you value money? What's your relationship with money? If you don't get at that, then you just don't understand why someone spends and behaves and thinks the way they do. So it's good to get at this from sort of a positive and value-oriented place for sure. I think it's helpful.
Yeah, and around the money piece, I mean, in some families, giving gifts was not something that they did. It was a waste of money. They may have lived in poverty, and they could barely pay the bills. So if your partner is looking for gifts and you don't give them to them, and you're getting into conflicts because you don't give birthday gifts, you don't give gifts on holidays, it's maybe your partner is thinking that you don't love them. And you're getting into these huge arguments when the fact of the matter is you're just not comfortable giving gifts because you're saving for a rainy day and you've never shared that with your partner, right?
Yeah, and even the idea of security, because a lot of us grow up in whatever economic status we're in, and we don't have a lot of perspective on how that might look different. But people that do tend to grow up in poverty or in very wealthy situations tend to have a little bit more focus on the importance of security and money as inherent value in itself. And so the idea of security is pretty huge. If you grew up in poverty and you went without, and someone's spending your money in ways that you don't like or that you're not talking about, that's going to create some emotional issues for sure.
Yeah, and triggers that you may not understand. Yeah, for
Exactly.
sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the second question to ask your partner is, does your position on this conflict relate to your history or childhood in some way? And I will tell you, and I've said this or I've shared this on the podcast before, one of the conflicts that I used to get into with my ex-husband was I always wanted to eat dinner together. And he didn't see, at least I don't think he saw the value of that. For me, that was in my family the time when we always all got together. And during holidays, we had meals together with family, extended family. And that showed me that I was loved. So when my ex did not want to have dinner together every single night, which was a lot for me to ask of him anyway, if he was working late or whatever. I saw that as something that it wasn't, and we would get into conflicts, or I would initiate or start the conflict. So, do you have any thoughts about that one? Does your position relate to your history or childhood in some way?
Super important, very super important. Goes back to that idea of family culture, what you were brought up in. Again, what you know is kind of what you know. You may not know anything different. And so when there's a different family culture, a different perspective that you're bringing to your relationship and your new family, those are things that you absolutely have to work through. And it's one of the things that my wife and I shared around the importance of family dinner time, and we talked about that. And since we talked about that, it was easy to navigate, right? We both had some strong values around that and wanted our to have a place where the family sort of came together. So yeah, absolutely. And so as I often talk about, there's hardware and there's software. And when it comes to the family of origin stuff, the cultural stuff, that's all software. That's all stuff that you were socially sort of conditioned into and encultured into. And that's a big part of what we need to understand about how we see relationships and family.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, many of us don't know that we were raised by a neurodivergent parent or parents, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, where our family got together for dinner, when my father and I realized after my father's passing in 2005 that he was autistic, but as soon as the meal was finished, he left the table. And he would ask, it was a joke because he would say, "Can I be excused?" At least he was polite about it and didn't just get up and leave. And so it was literally every meal that's how it happened. And so for me, that time together was precious and important. And then I knew when he got up, you know, that was the end of the conversation with him. So yeah, looking at that is really, really important. So yeah. Question number three is, why is your position on this issue important to you? And one of the things that I think we all in neurodiverse relationships have to think about is that I may be able to tell my partner immediately why this, why my position on this issue is important to me. I may be very, very, very aware of what's going on, but my partner may need time to think about it. So as you're going through these questions, there may need to be a pause, or you may need to write down the questions and each of you review them and maybe jot down some thoughts before you actually talk about them. So I just want to kind of put that out there because I love the Gottmans' work. I absolutely love it, but they didn't do their research with neurodiverse couples in particular, although many of the people they talk about in their books absolutely are neurodiverse couples. Yeah. So any thoughts about why is your position on this issue important to you?
Yeah. Again, I think it's again, deferring your side to understand the other person's side, you know, and part of, you know, talk about with repair is we want to diffuse the reactivity in the back and forth, and we want to get on each other's page, you know? And so the importance of it, again, it's like, you're trying to create a bridge here, you know, you're trying to understand, you know, what is going on in the other person, what is really important there. And so it's good to have, like you said, maybe some reflective statements like, okay, am I getting this right? This is why this is important. And so really trying to get on each other's side and getting into each other's perspective and also valuing that even when they don't align, you know, so I think you have to be able to say, this is really important to my partner. Therefore, it's important to me, right? Yeah. I may not share it. I may not quite get it, you know, but you want to sort of, you know, have some respect and be able to honor what's really important for your partner.
Yeah, that's why I feel that using the mic is so important when you're asking these questions and you're digging deeper, because I know I am the kind of person that interrupts. My ADHD brain has really had to retrain, you know, and build new neural pathways. And, you know, I hear this from a lot of neurodivergent folks. They have the idea, they want to just, you know, kind of spit it out. And so, yeah, that doesn't work, especially when you're trying to repair and really understand your partner. So question number four is, what are your feelings about this issue? And again, you're asking all these questions when you and your partner are regulated, or at least as close to being regulated, your nervous system regulated as you can get. And you're not asking these questions in the middle of a conflict. You're asking these questions to repair a major rupture when you have the time and the space to go through them. So what are your feelings about this issue? And for those that have alexithymia, this may be a very difficult one.
Yes.
Right? Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah. So this is one that you're going to need even more space around potentially. And you're also going to need, you know, maybe a just slower pace or more processing time around a question around feelings. That becomes very complicated for people. And that also again, so we have to accept the fact that the answer in that moment might be, I'm not sure, or I don't know. And, you know, and then this is also, as these questions build, I think there might be the ability for the holistic person with their autistic alexithymic partner to also say, does it get you frustrated? Does it make you feel insecure? To kind of prompt them as a way to sort of also make those connections. And so there might need to be a little bit more tweaking and work around this particular question as it relates to these Gottman techniques, which are fantastic and often work wonderfully for neurodiverse couples. But there are things like this that will get trickier.
Yeah, I agree. And sometimes, you know, the question could be, are you experiencing anything in your body? You know, is your stomach feeling sick? Are your arms feeling tense? Your shoulders, your neck? Are you wanting to cry? Are you wanting, you know, to storm out? Do you feel like you need to get out in nature?
Yes.
Because, right, all of those things can be helpful too. Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, I think those are fantastic questions.
Yeah. So that can be a tough one, I think, for neurodiverse couples. And we've got two more. So number five is one of my favorite. So it's, what is your ideal dream here? If you could wave a magic wand and have exactly what you want, what would that look like? And I wish that I had asked my ex-husband that question. But I bet you, Greg, if I had, in the kind of perpetual problems we had, even the solvable problems, I'm not sure that he would have been able to answer that question in the moment, right? And even if he had thought about it and was able to answer it, I do, and I've said this many times on the podcast, I do wonder if masking can come into place, where the autistic partner thinks that they have to say a certain thing because they've been with their partner so long and they know what they want, what their partner wants them to say. And so I would caution couples, when they're going, if you decide to use these questions or you decide to get this book, to really give each other space and time to think about, if you could wave a magic wand and have exactly what you want, what would that look like? And think about really being honest. And what that might mean is that you may not get to a place of agreement around this issue. You also may find that you're not very compatible around this issue or other issues. And I know that can be really tough, right? Any thoughts on that one?
I think this also piggybacks on with the last one, because one of the things that goes along a lot of times with alexithymia, not always, but I have this with some of my clients, is aphantasia. Aphantasia is some struggles with imagining or envisioning or, using some of those faculties. Now, some autistics are hypervisual. Some of them are actually hypovisual. And so aphantasia is being sort of hypovisual, which means I have a hard time creating an imaginative space where I can envision the scenario. And you can see how this relates to alexithymia. Like, I don't understand what I'm feeling. I don't understand what other people are feeling, because I can't really use those skills necessarily, or I struggle with those skills because of my wiring. Autistic people also like practicality. And so they also may respond to this question as, you know, this is dumb, because it's never going to happen. And that's not the way the world works, you know? And so there may be some rigidity or some deference toward practicality over exploring these type of things. But I think it's a great question. I really do. It's a question that I ask a lot of my clients, because we need to disrupt this thing, this thinking of how things kind of have to be, you know, and we need to explore really maybe what's missing for us, right?
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think that's true. And if I were to just put out the example of I want to eat dinner with you for 7 nights out of the week, every night of the week, right? That's my, if I could wave a magic wand, that's what I would have, right? And so that's very specific, that's very concise. And then the conversation can be around what is possible, what is doable. So, and that's where a therapist might be more helpful, right? As you're going through these questions. But you also could do that together as long as you can, I guess, be a little bit more flexible about black and white thinking. You know, it's not 7 nights or nothing. There's an ability to compromise for both partners, if they choose, right?
And when your ability to compromise and to honor someone else's needs usually and ideally gets paid back to you. So when you both give a little space, you'll tend to come closer together and you'll want to do more of it. So absolutely. And I think, when you really honor something that's really valuable to somebody and say, I hate sitting down to eat dinner, but it's important to you, so I'm going to try to do that. Yeah, three days a week. Let's figure that out. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. And what do you need? If you're willing to do the 3 days, what do you need? Do you need a half hour before you come to the dinner table to unwind? So again, I think there's so much good in these questions and so much potential for repairing these major ruptures when we understand kind of what's underneath them. Because when we're in that conflict, we're seeing the surface. You know, when we're fighting about money, or we're fighting about, you know, getting home late from work, or we're fighting about, you know, going on vacation to particular locations, there's something underneath that that we may or may not be aware of. And there's something underneath that that we can discuss if these become, you know, perpetual problems or solvable problems. And just for those folks that aren't familiar with the term perpetual problems, they're perpetual because they're due to our personalities, our neurotypes, our family of origin, you know, our wants, our needs that maybe we haven't vocalized and shared with our partner, but they're probably not ever going to change. And that's why they're perpetual. And so if you stay stuck on those, you're going to be in a repeated place of conflict, and it's not going to get resolved. Yeah.
And you may be hurting each other as it relates to some of your core values.
Yes.
I think when conflict starts to come up, I think it's very easy to go to deficit and negative thinking about the
Yes.
situation, about the other person, instead of like what this encourages, which is sort of this digging into what's important, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the last question, and I'll put all six questions in the show notes for those of you that need to see them, you know, laid out. The last one is there some underlying purpose or goal in this for you, and what is it? So again, you know, going to the back to the money issue, if one of you is repeatedly saying, I don't want to go on vacation, I don't want to spend the money, what is it that's underlying that? Is it that you want to save for retirement because your parents never did, and they, you know, had to live in a house that was dilapidated and they couldn't afford, you know, their medicine and what have you? Those are things we don't necessarily discuss with our partners. You know, so is there some underlying purpose or goal? Yeah, I don't want to end up like my parents. You know, I want to be able to be healthy financially in retirement. So, you know, going on big vacations every year, even though they're fun, that takes thousands and thousands of dollars out of our savings account or what could potentially be our retirement account. You know, but we don't necessarily share that. We say, no, I don't want to go on vacation, or I don't like that place you're thinking of, or whatever, right?
Yeah, great question. And it's just about putting your finger on naming it, getting at it, getting at what is going on here, what is it that you really want out of that? And again, I think it makes it easier to get on each other's side when these positive things that are really important to each other.
Yeah. And I think when you're going through this process and you're asking each other these questions and you're giving each other space and time to answer them, which may look very different for each couple, having a curiosity mindset, I think, is really, really, really important. Because if you're not curious and you don't care what your partner's answers are to these questions, then I think it's really difficult to repair these ruptures. And I would suggest you go to a therapist or a coach if you're willing to, or if not, you may be at a point where you're no longer compatible. So just some things to think about, because not all ruptures can be repaired. And when you have them repeatedly, it may be time to reevaluate whether you and your partner should be together anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to because, you know, if, you know, one of the most important traits, and again, I have my singles and divorcees ask me this question all the time, what should I look for in a good partner or in a good dating situation, you know? And again, I often say openness and a growth mindset. If you don't have that, you're going to have real struggles growing together, you know? And so that curiosity piece is really important. I often reference this idea of talking past one another. And again, I think it emphasizes or goes back to the idea of the importance of turn taking and slowing down the listening process and really, yeah, really being able to listen. And I think when you do that, when you do some of these exercises that create space for listening, you will notice how your brain or your ideas want to jump in or to cut off or to, you know, change the focus or whatever. And having to hold that back tells you a lot about what's going on in the conflicts as you are sort of talking past each other.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we get into these ruts where we've, and I'm going to use the word, always done it this way in our relationship, and we literally don't know how to shift to be more curious or to have a growth mindset. And if you don't, and you want to heal together, and you want to grow as a couple, and you want to repair all these major ruptures that have occurred because you didn't know you were a neurodiverse couple, and you didn't understand your attachment styles, and you didn't understand your trauma or your childhood wounds, you know, finding the right therapist who understands neurodiverse couples and neurodivergence is going to be so important. And I've said this so many times on the podcast, if you're working with a therapist who does not understand neurodiverse couples, it absolutely can do more harm than good. Because we're talking about subjects that they may not have very much knowledge about, you know, RSD, rejection sensitivity dysphoria, alexithymia, and some of the other things we've talked about in other episodes. You have to understand that because that is the reality for a lot of neurodiverse couples,
Yep,
right?
absolutely. You need that lens, you need that context. Otherwise, yeah, you're just kind of coming at it from one perspective. And then you end up getting aligned with the holistic partner a lot of times instead of really being able to see and help. Mediate and create those bridges of understanding between the couple that may have very different processing styles.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so the other topic that we wanted to talk about a little bit was trouble maintaining a job, because it was an issue for me in my marriage, not so much trouble maintaining a job, but trouble working to your potential and then staying on a career path that would allow my ex to contribute in the way I thought he was capable of contributing financially. And but I've heard so many folks who've come through my couple support group talk about, you know, the trouble maintaining a job. So what I realized, Greg, is I had no boundaries around this issue, right? And we talked about PDA in a past episode, and I think this was something that came into play over and over again, because when you are on a clear career path and you expect your partner to be on a clear career path, and they do not understand their neurotype, and you don't understand your neurotype and their neurotype and the differences, there may be some major underlying reasons why your partner is not able to keep a job or is not able to fulfill their potential. And I'm going to share my perspective, and I would love to hear, your thoughts. I don't think that most workplaces take neurodiversity into consideration. So, and this is, this is not a great epiphany. It's just I'm speaking the obvious. And so if you're going to a workplace where there's a lot of fluorescent lights, you have to work in a big open area, there's all kinds of sound, people are talking nonstop, you have no private space. The work hours are such that, you're more productive from noon to six, but the office opens at 8. You know, there's no flexibility in the hours you can work or where you can work. And you're very black and white. So when you're at a meeting and somebody shares with you or shares at the meeting something that you know is wrong or in your mind is wrong, and you bluntly tell that person in a not so nice tone of voice, you can be written up. You can be written up numerous times because it keeps happening. And then you can lose the job, or before you get fired, you leave because you're just so fed up with, all these sensory things and all the things that you're being asked to do at meetings that make no sense to you or are just plain stupid in your mind. So, I mean, I'm just being very blunt because, I hear this all the time, I see it. And then the other thing that I think happens with the not achieving your potential is because there's so little flexibility in a lot of workplaces, if you're a creative person and it takes you months to get the job finished and there's a deadline of weeks, even though your end result could be 100 times better than anybody else's end result, you've still got deadlines to meet, right? So when the deadlines come up and you decide, I'm done, I can't, because it's not going to be perfect, and then you leave or you're fired because you didn't meet the deadline, there are underlying reasons that need to be explored or issues that need to be explored. And I guess for me now, I realize, with my ex, the best environment for him to be in and succeed was one with tremendous flexibility. In fact, I remember him saying to me at some point, I kind of want to be a truck driver. And he didn't say that because he really wanted to be a truck driver. But I now know what he wanted is he wanted that freedom to be on the road, to be flexible, to make his own time, work his own days, the days he wanted to work during the time frames he wanted to work. So for those couples where this is an issue, whether it's your partner is losing jobs or they can't seem to, they're losing them because they're getting fired or they're leaving them because it's not working out, these are things that are probably underneath that iceberg that you may want to talk about again, as a couple or with a therapist or coach. What are your thoughts?
You hit on so many great things there, Mona. One of the things we have to recognize, and I think again, I think your statement about the neurotypical world isn't set up to really work for the neurodivergent people, and because of that, our journey often looks more troubled and more difficult. How do we find ourselves in this place that we don't fit in? And we also have such strong values in our autonomy and wanting to do things our own way that this creates problems in terms of the expectations of the workplace and the expectations of society overall. And a lot of times our journeys look more stumbly and more troubled because of that. Some of this obviously isn't the neurodivergent person's fault. They are just trying to figure it out and can't understand why things are going bad so often, you know? And there are so many things that happen to neurodivergence in the workplace. And you've named a lot of them. There's a ton more too. But I think once you have enough negative experiences in the workplace, a lot of, and I went through this too, neurodivergents take up these very all or nothing, black and white negative narratives about the world and themselves in the world. And so it's very troubled. You know, one of the things my wife said to me at one point is, why can't you just earn money so we can get by better? You know? And I was like, you know, I want to, but if I do that, if I sort of what I call, you know, sell my soul, you know, which I did for periods of time, I would become incredibly depressed.
Yeah.
You know, and incredibly unhappy. And she didn't want to be around that either, you know, but she couldn't understand why I couldn't work a full-time job, you know, or why I couldn't maintain that job, you know. And so capacity here is a really important thing. The work schedule also is another aspect of this, but it hasn't been until I've gotten into my late 40s that I can work close to a full-time work week, you know, but I always gravitated toward academia or to places where I could find space or make a more schedule that was broken up, or I had a little bit more, it was a little bit more about me. And again, autistics have a very spiky skill set too. So if workplaces were able for you to be specifically do your thing and do it your way and to be able to utilize that, it would be easier. But instead, we're expected to do a lot of things, and some of those overlap into social things, social norms, teamwork, collaboration that create more problems for us. And I try to normalize this process for a lot of my neurodivergents by saying, no, it's okay to jump around in your job. It's going to create stressors for you, for sure. And yes, you don't like change, but I think you're better off trying to find out where is the culture, where is the job situation that can fit you. And if you don't do that, you're going to be miserable. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some neurodivergents that also, you know, which were kind of like my mom, which I call sort of, you know, blue collar Buddhists, where they could do the same thing over and over and over again without it having really any meaning to them. And as long as it was consistent and created security and it was predictable, they're completely happy, you know?
That I would go crazy, Greg. I would absolutely go crazy.
Right. Same here. I'm like, no. I couldn't do that. And that's one thing my mom would, you know, almost shame me about, you know, too. And so I almost got that from my wife to some extent, you know. And here's one other aspect that really happens in terms of burnout for neurodivergence is they will try so freaking hard at the beginning of a job to make sure they're learning everything, they're proving themselves, they're going above and beyond, and they can't maintain that. But the job actually notices it, thinks they're absolutely amazing, and then they sort of create this covert contract around what the expectations are there for them at work, and they end up getting burdened with more and more work, actually. And so you almost set yourself up a lot of times as a neurodivergent, as you're trying so hard because you don't want to fail again, right? You don't want to be rejected again. You don't want to deal with that change again. You want to find yourself here and you want to prove yourself so bad. But it actually ends up sort of sabotaging the situation.
Yeah. And that can create, going back to, you know, repairing ruptures, so much conflict within yourself and within your relationship. I think one of the biggest conflicts that my ex and I had was over his work, because he didn't work for almost 8 years. It was a little over 7 years, I think. And he would have been fine never going back to work if if I had married him knowing
Right,
that,
right.
and that was our agreement at the beginning, I'm going to be the primary breadwinner. If you want to work part time, feel free. If you want to raise our daughter, feel free. But that was not the contract we had. That was not the agreement we had. So what I think it's really important for neurodiverse couples to think about is what changed in the beginning, from the beginning of your relationship, because if both of you were employed or both of you were in school or one of you was in school and one of you was employed and things were going well, and then there was some kind of rupture where, one of you either lost more than one job or quit more than one job and never seemed to get, his or her their footing, what happened? And I think you need to go deep. You need to look at the environment. You need to look at the type of bosses you've had. You need to look at your work hours. You need to look at the commute. Are you having to get on a subway or a train or a bus or drive in traffic for an hour? And that is literally exhausting you. And you have no spoons left when you get to work. So you're extremely agitated and your nervous system is extremely dysregulated. We haven't really talked about this in depth on the podcast, but it's so important. And then when you repeatedly are getting into fights with your partner because they can't keep a job or because they keep quitting because of all these things, and they've never talked to you about what's going on inside their bodies and their hearts and their minds and their souls and what they're thinking about, it feels like you are with somebody that you don't even recognize anymore, especially if things were very different in the beginning, right? Yeah, you can tell this is an issue that is really important to me because it was so major in our relationship. Yeah, I almost divorced my ex-husband our fourth year of marriage because I felt like he had all this potential and was not using it. Like he was having a part-time job here or there. Meanwhile, I'm getting my master's and working full-time,
It looks so different. And again, what is normal, what is right, all these things have to be looked more closely at. And one thing that I really valued with my wife is that we did have a sense of that there was going to be turn taking, and particularly as it went to academia, to a job and stuff like that. I just happened to be in a field which was horrible for consistent work too, which was the art field, and it really hurt my self-worth. I mean, I did not believe I was valued in the world. I came home, I didn't believe I was valued. I didn't believe that I belonged, and I was so convinced, I was so stuck on, I knew what I was supposed to do and I couldn't do it. And that hit my sense of self, my sense of identity, my sense of belonging so hard. But to tell you the truth, that's what it took for me to change, is to hit rock bottom around my career. And now I kind of thank God that I did. But yeah, I mean, and of course, a lot of the autistic partners end up kind of getting parentified in that, where the autistic person's struggling and they feel burdened by like maintaining the job and maintaining the finances, and it becomes a very uneven situation, which again can create a lot of conflict. It's a hard thing to move through, and there's so many factors involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know, you don't have to answer this, but I really appreciate you sharing what you shared and being so transparent. What do you think? You said you hit rock bottom, but what do you think made you kind of transition into a new career path that allowed you to have more maybe financial stability? Was it just hitting rock bottom or something else?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I knew it was hard for me to do, but I was stuck on it. I was stuck on it. I was convinced. I mean, I was very successful in my academic life in terms of my art career And that was also fed to me very early on because I was a little bit of a savant, you know. I was drawing realism in grade school while people were drawing, you know, rainbows and flowers. And it's funny because there's a mural that went up in our elementary school. And I remember coming back and seeing it at some point. And yeah, it was exactly that. It was like rainbows and flowers and sunshine. And then I had this like realistic man jumping out of the water with these like abstract forms around it. And on one side, it didn't fit at all, right?
I love it.
And I had, you know, full ride scholarship. I was ranked nationally as a visual artist. You know, wow. I had all these accolades and all these awards. And so I was convinced that's what I should be, you know, so that was part of it. And then I don't know if I've told this story before, but I've had a couple strange Christmases where, and I'm not like a super religious person or anything, but where I've been like hit by like something. And one of these Christmases, I decided to write down everything I had gone through in my life, everything I'd overcome, everything I'd gone through, and it was exhaustive. I mean, I was going back as far as I could remember. And my first memory is extremely powerful. And I think it says a lot about my autistic nature. Again, my parents were sort of push you out the door and take care of yourself type people. And I was 3 years old. I remember my mom was doing something at the kitchen table and I didn't know what to do. And I came up to her and I said, mommy, what should I do? And she said, I don't know. I want you to go out and play, you know, take, you know, go barefoot, go run outside somewhere, you know, do your thing. And I said, well, what would you do if you're me? And I don't know if I asked that question, but it was something like that. And she was like, I don't remember when I was three.
Oh, and wow.
That hit me so hard. Like, I don't exist. That was the feeling I had. It was trauma. I mean, like you wouldn't believe. I mean, I was like, I don't matter. I don't exist.
Wow.
And I walked outside and I decided that I was going to remember this moment for the rest of my life, no matter what it took. And I went and I looked at a brick on the wall next to our door as hard as I could with like all the energy in my being. And I just stared and stared and stared and stared and stared and stared and stared. And of course, I've remembered that moment for the rest of my life. That's where the list started. And then I made a list of everything I could possibly be. So it was like taking inventory of my strengths and what I overcome, and then how that could apply in the world. And I remember I got to the bottom of the list and I wrote art therapist and counselor. And I'm boom.
Wow.
It just hit me like a wave. And I knew what I'd been missing. I mean, as soon as I started teaching, I remember my first class in graduate school that I taught, and I had a student run up to me at the end of class and say, oh my God, this was so awesome. You should go into art therapy. And I was like, ha ha ha, you know, it's like, that's a great compliment. You know, that's all I thought about, you know, I mean, and I used a lot of psychological and expressive tools and it was very creative and out of the box, you know, very divergent. And then that sort of stuff clicked, you know, like people were telling me that and telling me that. And then I had some powerful experiences of exploring and challenging myself in different places too. So I often talk about working at the Des Moines Arts Center, where I worked with right away with an autistic adult who was just the most amazing artist. And the diversity, worked with veterans and teens and refugees and special needs adults. And it was amazing. And I was like, there's something more here, right? And so ever since I moved, I got all these universal sort of confirmations. So that's what it took for me, which was kind of crazy, magical. I don't know how anyone else is going to apply that to themselves, but that's what my journey looked like.
Wow. I love several things that you said, that you looked at kind of this timeline of your life. And there's a book, and I've had a guest on the podcast talk about this, and it's actually it's the grief recovery method. And one of the exercises they have in the book is to do a timeline of the times in your life where you experienced grief. And when I did it, there were core places in my life and core times in my life that I went back to that I had forgotten were major milestones because of grief. Like a friend of mine moving when I was in fourth grade, who was my best friend, and I didn't know if I'd ever see her again. And I think what you're talking about is also, it's almost like the two could be paired. It's like, what are the significant times in your life when you felt peace, joy, happiness, if you could even identify those? And what are the times where you felt, grief or angst or anger or whatever? And how do you weave the happiness, peace, joy things to your life on a more regular basis? And is it possible to make that your career? Go ahead.
So yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think what I was doing was trying to rework my whole sense of myself. And trying to reopen that up through both of those lenses, kind of what I'd been through, and what I could possibly be because of that, and I remember, just trying to work that back and forth in my head, and that makes a lot of sense to me.
I'm glad, and what you did made a lot of sense to me. And I know for my ex, I mean, he is very, very gifted and very, very talented and very, very creative. That's where our daughter gets it. She doesn't get it from me. I have none of those musical talents. I have none of those writing skills. I mean, I have better writing skills than I did, 25 years ago. But they are very prolific. I mean, my ex has probably written 100 plus songs. And I think the difference I see between the two of them, my daughter and my ex, is they both have very similar skills and talents, in my opinion. But I don't think my in-laws ever supported emotionally my ex-husband's creative skills and talents. And they always wanted him to do something that was more professional, you know? So, and I did support them, but I think because I was not there in his formative years, and I think this is really something to look at for neurodiverse couples. If your partner is supportive of you using your gifts and your talents to create a career path that will allow you to be happy and peaceful and successful, and you don't feel that you're worthy of that, go to therapy. Get yourself a really good therapist who understands neurodiversity and neurodivergence and work through that, because you deserve to be doing something in your career that brings you joy and peace, I believe.
I think and I think this is really poignant. So it ties back to some of the things to the Gottman questions, which was the way I got approval and attention from my parents was being creative, was doing stuff they were just blown away with. And I spent so much time alone manifesting and investing in my drawing and investing in my imagination. And because of that neglect, there was so much held upon my artistry, my creativity, that it created tremendous risk for me in terms of what I could do otherwise, right? How I could see those traits in sort of a bigger way. And so some of those attachment wounds were mixed in with actually my job stuff, right? And this goes back to those Gottman questions, which are sort of wanting to sort of get at, the whys and what happened and what's important.
And you're talking about your family of origin. I mean, I mentioned this earlier. We may not know if our parent or parents or whoever was our caregivers were autistic, if they've, died, or if they're still living, are autistic. And it's not, I'm not saying this because you have to run out and tell your parent, oh, I know you're autistic because I listened to the Neurodiverse Love podcast and now I understand why you did some of the things you did. But when you understand the neurotypes of your caregivers and you have some wounds attached to their caregiving style, you can move forward and heal with the right support. Again, a therapist or a coach. Because I had, and still I carry them with me, some origin wounds around trust. Because, and it's a big one for me. And I was actually thinking about it before we got on the podcast because my father repeatedly said he was going to do things for or with my sister and I, or my sister and I and my mother, and then wouldn't follow through. So that origin wound, that childhood wound of wanting to trust my father, not trusting him because there were so many breaches of trust, then getting into a marriage where the same thing happened. I think, of course, we know we pick our partners because we have an opportunity to create a conscious relationship where we work through these childhood wounds. But I didn't know that at the time, Greg. I didn't know that. And instead, what I did, and what many of you may resonate with, is that I created these conflictual situations, these perpetual problems over and over again, because I didn't have the awareness of this trust childhood wound.
I again, I think it's really important. And yeah, so you're almost asking the question is, what if our partners are actually a source and a mirror for our healing? You
Yes.
know, and so the importance of our relationships and what we learn from them and what we can now own or gain empowerment for and find healing through is such an awesome message.
Yeah. I think that it, and that's also a great last thought, before we close out. I love that. I think, many of us try really, really, really hard to heal the wounds that we have from childhood and that the additional wounds that we gain in our relationships. But if we don't understand our neurotype and we don't understand our partner's neurotype, trauma, issues from family of origin, all those things. And when we have a rupture and we're going through conflict, if we can use some of the questions, if not all the questions that we asked from the Gottman book, I think, there are opportunities for healing and growth, but gosh, there are also so many times where there's unintentional hurt and pain and toxicity that can really destroy you. And, of course, we want the positive. We can't ever have a life with no negative and no conflict. That's not healthy either. But knowing, what is underneath some of those conflicts and whether they're perpetual or they're solvable is really, really helpful. So, do you have any last thoughts before we close out?
No, just amen. And it's always a pleasure to see where our conversations go, Mona. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I agree, Greg. It's been a pleasure to have you again as a co-host. And, I think a lot of the topics that we've discussed have been really, really helpful to listeners. And I know that, we're going to do things in the future. For those that are interested, Greg and I are doing a mixed neurotype support group. It is the third Friday of the month from 12:30 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And it's only $25 per session. And again, it's mixed neurotype. So no matter what your neurotype is, you can join us. And we're really focusing on what are the things that you want to talk about and work through and get support from others on related to how to thrive in your neurodiverse relationship. So I hope if you're interested, you can go to my website, neurodiverselove.com, to my shop, and you can get the link. And I'll also put it in the show notes. And Greg, for those folks that want to reach out to you, what is the best place for them to contact you?
Yeah, email me gfuqua70@gmail.com is my email. You can find that through Psychology Today or my website at gregfuqua.com, and feel free to reach out to me. I do coaching and consulting on the side. I do mental health counseling as well in the state of Iowa. So feel free to reach out.
I hope that as you move forward, you can figure out how you can be more curious about your partner so that you can begin to understand each other better. Thank you.